from KQED.
From KQED Public Radio in San Francisco, I'm Michael Krasny. Good morning and welcome to this hour of our forum program. Sherman Alexie joins us in studio, the author of 22 books, including the 2007 National Book Award winning for young people, The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian. He also received the Penn 2010 Faulkner Award and a Penn Hemingway Special Citation and the 2000 Penn Malamud Award for Excellence in the Art of the Short Story. A film he wrote and co-produced, Smoke Signals, won the Audience Award and Filmmaker's Trophy at the 1998 Sundance Film Festival, and he recently published a collection of new and selected stories titled Blasphemy. Sherman Alexie grew up on a reservation near Spokane. He now lives in Seattle and joins us for this Forum Hour. And I was thinking, boy, it's about time we got together here on Forum. You live in not that far from us and yet have never graced our studios. Good to have you here.
Thanks. Yeah, I was realizing that. And, I've been in San Francisco on book tour about 800 times. So.
Well, and I've been a reader of your work for many, many years. It's a pleasure to have you here. Why call this blasphemy?
It's sort of tongue-in-cheek. I've been accused of it by Indians and non-Indians, so I thought, why not embrace the label? And the cover of the book has me in the skies, the heavens, laughing underneath blasphemy in red. So it was sort of my scarlet letter homage.
I noticed that the dedication is to the red group, whomever they may be. Speaking of red and homages.
Yes, that the mysterious red group. That's a very inside secret.
Well, you grew up on a reservation, as I said in the introduction, and in some ways, what's fascinating about this new collection is you've got the early stories and more recent stories kind of divided 15-15, and you can see a metamorphosis. I mean, there's been, in some ways, more of a movement. All of that reservation upbringing is still very intact in your memory and very strong in your identity and so forth, but you also have all those effects of what we dare call the universalization of Native American identity.
Well, I've lived off the reservation now since, the last time I lived there full time was after college. So that was 1991. So I haven't lived on the reservation in about 21 years. So it's about time I start reflecting my urban life. And also in Native American literature in general, even though nearly every big name Indian writer lives in a city or teaches at a college, very, very little of Native American literature is about the urban experience. So in some ways, it's a new genre, the focus on urban life.
Well, I see some of it in Louise Erdrich, I must say. I mean, particularly more recent work. But there's also that sense in Mamadé and I'm thinking about writers like Leslie Silko, where they feel they have to go back even to do volunteer work. That's true for you, isn't it?
Yeah. I mean, I spend a lot of time in the Indian community, and it's not an obligation. It's who I am. But that obligation or that sense of belonging tends to exclude the urban Indian identity. And in fact, it favors the reservation identity over the urban identity. So Native American literature is very res-centric. And I guess with my book, and this book in particular, I'm trying to, paint a fuller picture of what it means to be Native American.
Well, sometimes that picture comes across almost in, I was looking over some of the earlier stories, particularly looking over a story which I really like about a guy who's looking for his grandmother's regalia, a homeless guy called Homeless in Seattle as opposed to Sleepless in Seattle.
It's still starring Tom Hanks, though, the movie adaptation.
It's what you I will redeem.
What you pawn, I
will redeem. Yeah, it's because all about the pawnbroker who turns out to be a really kind guy. But I just looked through it and I said, Indians like to belong. Indians are good at silence. This is a homeless guy, but from his perspective, there's these broad brushstrokes about Indians, which does appear a lot in your early work. And I thought, with all the tribes, with all the heterogeneity, with all the urban living and everything, how much can we really generalize about Indians?
Well, in terms of specific tribal identities, not really. But when you start talking about urban Indians or when you start talking about Native Americans in general, there is this sort of place where all these separate tribal influences come into this sort of one identity. So it's like being American. I can walk up to any American and start talking about, let's say, Obama or Romney or have this common dialogue. And in the Native American world, that's the same thing. We can talk about powwows or politics or the meaning of casinos and sovereignty or tell a few jokes that everybody knows. So there is a common Native American culture identity that's separate from each tribal individual identity.
Yeah, I was reading an interview you did where you were talking about your liberal politics and liberal social policies particularly, and then said that you see yourself embattled against conservatives and alluded to the fact that many Native Americans are quite conservative. In fact, I think you used the word redneck at one point.
Yeah, redskin rednecks. The only difference is between, you know, small-town white conservatives and reservation conservatives is, you know, Indians have better hair. So, I was unhappy growing up for a lot of reasons, but one of the primary ones is that I was born liberal, you know, and who knows why that happens. My parents ranged from, you know, not caring, apathy, to pretty conservative. You know, my mom loves Sarah Palin. So where I came from, I don't know. And so growing up in that environment, in a reservation environment, I mean, it's a theocracy. Reservations are theocracies surrounded by religion informing every decision, no separation of church and state, pro-war, pro-gun, generally anti-gay. So I rebelled against that early on, and I'm still rebelling against it in, you know, whatever package it comes from.
And yet your Indian identity appears to be very intact and maybe even sacred in some ways. I hesitate to use that word, but, you know, you use blasphemy as a title, so I'll... I want to talk with you about some of the things that have been almost co-opted by... I mean, you have a lot of young people going into sweat lodges, and there's all this sense of having some connection to Indian identity from the outside. And you've actually even had your own identity ripped off. I mean, writers claiming to be Sherman Alexie, reading your stories. Didn't you get in a brawl once over something like that?
You know, there's a rumor I got in a brawl. I was just reading it online, and I thought, I haven't hit anybody since, you know, at a YMCA in 1991. So I don't know where that rumor came from.
It's typical internet.
There have been brawls in my audience, but I haven't been involved in them. I've just been an eyewitness to bookstore brawls.
So this story about somebody actually reading your story and you're coming in and insisting that this shouldn't be done, that your identity was being co-opted?
Never... Well, I didn't do it in person. It was in print. Ah. So there have been a couple people who've been like Nasdij, who ended up being a white guy, pretending to be a Navajo, pretending to have had this life on the reservation, but wrote in a style that was very similar to mine. And his story appeared in Esquire. And I picked up Esquire and I thought, who is Indian guy? And now the Indian world is tiny, 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 tiny. And the Indian writing world is even smaller. So the idea of somebody showing up out of nowhere is pretty impossible. So I was suspicious from the very beginning. And then reading the story, I caught hints of my work and hints of other people's work. And I immediately questioned him I talked to his editor, who I knew, and I told him he wasn't real. And it turns out he wasn't. I was right, but people didn't believe me. And any Navajo who read his Navajo work instantly knew as well, because there were so many cultural errors. But we don't have any authority over our own depictions or our own lives. We're a colonized people, so the colonizers always get preference.
Well, what about when the children of colonizers, for example, or the generations the colonizers spawn, to use a word that's probably not a great one?
Well, that's good. I'm a salmon people. I'm from the salmon people.
Yeah,
spawn is a good word.
I want to ask you about that, because when you write in your stories, you know, there's all this spirituality connected to salmon. You know, in one story, a visionary kind of storyteller sees the character Victor's father in a salmon, and another story there's a sense of the ghost salmons and so forth. So a lot of young people read this, and I think it may account for some of your popularity, which I wonder how you feel about. You know, they read, he's giving me this Indian spiritual stuff that I can absorb.
You know, it's around salmon, but I do not delve into specific spiritual practices. I stay away from overt religious imagery and ceremonies, because I know that they can be co-opted. So I do protect my spirituality, and I do protect the spirituality of my tribe by not getting too specific. I stay outside of it. And I don't want to culturally appropriate myself.
Does it bother you, though, when you say Native Americans are culturally appropriated, which is pretty commonplace? Like I said, the sweat lodges and all that sort of thing.
It bothers me. I used to get furious about it, but now I'm just sort of amused. And what it points out to is, you know, European Americans have actually been the ones who've completely abandoned and lost their culture. You know, if you go to any Indian community and ask them who participates in tribal ceremonies, pretty much everybody's going to raise their hand. If you ask that from a European Americans, you know, 2/3 of them aren't even going to realize that going to church is a European American tradition or speaking English is a European American tradition. They're so disconnected. So we Indians are worried about you white people. We're gonna have a telethon, restore European American culture.
Just don't get Jerry Lewis for it. Well, actually, there are more, believe it or not, there are more churchgoers in the United States. Of course, you have to factor in evangelicals and all that than there are churchgoers in the UK.
Well, I'm in Washington, so we're actually the most secular state in the country.
That's right, you are.
Yeah.
And you say that with some modicum of pride.
I say that with much pride. I live in Seattle, you know, which is the secular, socialist, high-tech capital of the country. So,
what do you think about the whole Elizabeth Warren flap? You know, there's a Boston Globe columnist who called her Pocahontas, which I thought was...
I hadn't heard that one. That's pretty funny.
That's pretty funny, yeah.
Well, you know, the whole idea that that your ancestors, you know, can determine who you are now, I mean, it's not true. I mean, I have a Russian great-great-grandfather. That does not make me Russian. You know, I did not grow up Russian. I've never been to Russia. I don't speak Russian. I have no idea what Russian ceremonies are.
Got some Russian DNA in you, though.
Yeah, but the DNA doesn't make me Russian. You know, an identity is a complicated mix of politics and culture and language and ceremony and spirituality and economics and action. It's not simply DNA. And the fact is, people like Elizabeth Warren or her supporters on the Indian identity battles, they're the ones who actually are obsessed with blood quantum or the idea that simply having the DNA makes you Indian. And that's not true. It's partly DNA, certainly, but it's mostly cultural.
Well, I like, for example, I was talking about those statements you make about Indians that you responded to by saying, you know, we have a similar culture, really, and we have similar things that we communicate with. Nobody loves Westerns like Indians. That's a direct quote from Sherman Alexie.
Well, it, you know, doesn't mean our identity isn't filled with irony. I mean, after all, we're called Indians. We're not Indians. We're called Native Americans. Native American means anybody born here.
Also called indigenous people.
Indigenous people, but we all came from Africa. So, you know.
Well, what about Amerindians?
Amerindians?
Remember that one?
I hate that one. That sounds so, it sounds like a sports car. You know, the you know, 2012 Amerindian. And, you know, I prefer to, you know, think of us as being here first.
Well, actually, I think you've said all, and I think we have a good deal of agreement on this, all literature is really about identity, particularly American literature. And I think at one point you said, it's only those of us who are Indians or who are called Indians who are really American writers. Everybody else is writing from a foreign identity, or at least in terms of their background, their cultural backgrounds.
I mean, all American literature is colonial literature. This is a colony. It's still a colony. You know, Canada is still a colony. And the fact is that Americans refuse or don't even think about the fact that they're colonial writers. You know, they're all Nadine Gordimer, incredible writers. You know, Nadine Gordimer calls herself a colonial writer. So
yes, I know
why,
she does.
Why doesn't Jonathan Franzen call himself a colonial writer?
Well, I suppose apartheid doesn't quite equate when you think about it.
You know.
Presently. all right, let's hear you on that. Okay.
You know, I mean, it's not official apartheid, but certainly the separateness of race.
Putting people on reservations, keeping them in barrios, keeping them in ghettos, that's the argument.
That's apartheid.
Why do you say that's apartheid?
Separating people by race?
Yeah, but purpose? it's
And the reservation system was created to destroy us.
But it was a whole, I mean, South Africa, of course, was a whole system of not only second class citizenship, but tertiary, I mean, you know, below that.
Native Americans weren't U.S. citizens until 1918.
Agreed. But there's still the sense that Native Americans can find their way into presently some kind of social and economic equality, isn't there?
You know, most Indians in this country live far below poverty and in some instances live in third world conditions. So in the richest country in the world, we have the indigenous people and living in third world conditions. That sounds like apartheid to me.
Well, we'll certainly hear from listeners on that, and they can reflect on the idea of whether or not this is apartheid. But you still see, in other words, Indians as a colonized people.
We are. We were colonized. And despite the fact that it was, you know, I mean, in terms of human history, in terms of our history as people in the Americas, you know, colonization, the Indian Wars officially ended in the early 20th century. It hasn't been that long. I knew people who were in the Indian Wars. So
actually, your grandfather fought in the major wars.
Yeah, he died in World War II. My grandmother, my maternal grandmother, her babysitter was Chief Joseph. So I am not disconnected from colonialism. You know, talk about 6 degrees of Kevin Bacon. You know, I'm 2 degrees from Chief Joseph.
Well, and then there are those who would say, but look at what changes America has gone through in civil rights, affirmative action, or attempts at affirmative action. There was one time when there were so many people trying to get into Stanford claiming that they had Native American roots or Native American DNA, you wouldn't have believed it. But there's also, you know, the arguments about casinos and ways that Indians can come out of this poverty that have been provided. You don't dispense with all that, do you?
No. I mean, the country isn't radically improved. I mean, that's one of the fights against conservatism. Be very suspicious of anybody who's nostalgic in the United States. And you think, what are you nostalgic for? Slavery, when women couldn't vote, the lack of child labor laws? So, no. I mean, I think the country is incredible. But in becoming incredible, people tend to forget the blood and pain that created it. This country is built by slavery and genocide.
Agreed. I also think that there have been some quantum changes.
We have a black president.
That's right. And it's amazing. Also, motion pictures, you know, when I was growing up as a kid, the Indians were all killers and villains and for the most part on the warpath and all that sort of thing. And
still pretty much the case.
Except for Tonto. but you know, we have these movies now that kind of...
And remember, South Africa had a black president before we did.
There's a lot of sentimentalization of. You didn't like Costner's movie, did you?
Oh no, I like it. It's a romantic, foolish epic. For Indians, it's a comedy.
We're talking again with Sherman Alexie. If you've just joined us, his new book is Blasphemy. It's new and selected stories. I mean, you've written poetry. You have a film that you've done, Smokescreen. But mainly
Smoke Signals.
Smoke Signals. Excuse me.
Smokescreen would have been better.
Yeah, no, Smoke Signals. Very, very much cultural, not smoke screens. But you're,
Smoke on the Water. That would have been good.
That would have been. You're still associated with storytelling, largely. I mean, that's your métier, isn't it?
Well, I'm a performer. I'm not a typical literary, boring reader. So, I mean, I get up and do comedy, and usually I have the stories memorized. And by the end of the book tour, I'll have the whole book memorized. But it was in college where, you know, I went to literary readings, and they were so, so awful. People monotone. And I just thought, I mean, you wrote this with passion, I'm assuming. Why aren't you performing it with passion? And so using the idea of stand-up comedy, a very Western construction, very Western artistic expression, and then tribal traditions of getting up around the fire, I tried to blend all of that, and then high school debate and all these cultural influences to get up and make the readings feel as close as possible to what you're actually writing about. I mean, if you're performing a love story, you better be filled with love.
But that's also a tradition of Native people. I mean, or Native Americans, the oral storytelling and reciting of.
It's
oral
a tradition story. For everybody. I mean, you know, the Odyssey is the oral tradition. The Iliad is the oral tradition.
But why the story? Why not, for example, because you've written a lot of poetry, why not novels? Because of performance, or is it that storytelling is more in your blood?
You know, I grew up on TV, too. So, I mean, I've always referred to myself as the practitioner of the Brady Bunch School of Native American Literature. So
how many are in that category?
I think 4 or 5 of us who would admit to it. You know, one of the things that happens for Native writers and Native people is getting really fundamental about the identity, the idea that you can't be influenced or you don't want to be influenced by European American cultural traditions. But it's far more complicated than that.
You embrace the Brady Bunch.
I embrace the Brady Bunch. Marsha, Marsha, Marsha. I embrace all sorts of aspects of Western civ.
And popular culture.
You know, I love Project Runway, you know. I love Cake Boss. So from the lowest low to the highest high, I enjoy American culture, and that doesn't make me less native. In fact, I think that would make I firmly embrace both sides. I'm Native American. I firmly embrace it,
it's a hybridized identity, I think, is what they used to call it, and that's what you're saying.
We're all hybrids.
I mean, and there's also the idea that if you're, say, Native American or African American or, you know, any kind of ethnicity and hybrid identity, you're still very much in the center of American culture. You go to the 7-Elevens and the supermarkets. I mean, it's all in your stories. That whole world is yours, especially if you're off the reservation. And even if you're on the reservation.
Well, you blend. I mean, walking here from the BART station, you know, because Seattle's very white, you know.
Yes.
And Seattle's very segregated. You know, one of the ironies of being, you know, probably the second or third most liberal city in the country, but also being very segregated. But walking here, you know, I mean, I blend completely. I could be any number of ethnicities.
You could be Russian.
I could be anything. Well, Alexei is my last name. I am Russian.
Yeah, I
know. So, I mean, you know, when I go to New York, when I'm walking through Brooklyn, I get spoken to in 150 different languages. Every time I get in a cab in New York, the cab driver thinks I'm half of whatever he is. So that's wondrous.
This is Forum. I'm Michael Krasny. Author Sherman Alexie broke into the literary scene in the mid-90s with The Lone Ranger and Tonto, Fistfight in Heaven, and other stories about growing up on a reservation. Since then, he certainly has not shied away from sensitive topics like alcoholism and domestic abuse among Native Americans. In his book, The Absolutely True Diary of a Part-Time Indian, won the National Book Award. He's here with us in studio. We're talking about all kinds of things related to Native American identity and his new book, Blasphemy, which is a collection of 15 new stories and 15 old favorites, covering topics from, as I said earlier, donkey basketball to wind turbines. What just happened to donkey basketball?
You know, I'm amazed how many people haven't heard of donkey basketball. You know,
I was one.
I mean, people think I made it up. But, you know, one thing, people, I mean, know me as an Indian, but they don't necessarily think of me as being a small town boy or a guy who grew up in a farm town. And donkey basketball was huge. It was a fundraiser, you know, where these donkey basketball companies would come in and you'd have students versus teachers or men versus women, you know, and teams would get it. You'd get up on the donkey and you'd
make an ass of yourself.
Exactly. You'd run around the court. And the donkeys were trained very well. I mean, they were incredible. There was like the LeBron James of donkey basketball, a donkey that would just run up and down the court. But then there was also like the old guy at the YMCA donkey that would stand in one place and not do anything. I wrote the story. It was nostalgic in a way. It was nostalgic for small town culture because donkey basketball doesn't really happen anymore. And the narrators of the story are actually white. So
basketball is very important in your work.
Yeah.
And, in fact, there's that Walt Whitman story where basketball turns out to have Walt Whitman play a central role. Let's talk about alcoholism, though, just for a moment before we bring our listeners, our callers and emailers into this, because it is such an ongoing scourge in the Native American communities throughout the country, and it remains so. And it's certainly something that you've taken on as a topic and appears in your work. At this point, I know you see addiction in general as a much more universal problem, but there's always that kind of pondering of why has alcohol been such a scourge?
It's cheap.
Alcohol, I mean, among Native Americans specifically.
Alcohol is cheap. And well, you look worldwide at colonized people. And addiction, especially alcoholism, is a constant problem. There's a huge amount of pain involved. And alcohol is a tranquilizer. It's a pain reliever, of course. I mean, that's the hope, but it doesn't. It just causes more agony. And I'm sure I'm going to get some callers or people are thinking right now, that's just a stereotype. That's just a stereotype. And it's not. Alcoholism is epidemic in the Indian world. I'm an alcoholic. I've been sober for a couple decades. My father died of alcoholism in 2003. I've had 11 close relatives die of alcohol-related causes.
And it's not stereotyping. I mean, the numbers are there.
No. So, I mean, it's something I deal with on a daily basis because I'm an alcoholic. And
how long have you been dry?
Since 1991. Yeah, so
that's great.
I think nothing gets me more angry than people questioning my depiction of alcoholism. I mean, it's a form of denial. And, you know, one of my jokes is that no sober Indian has ever complained about my depiction of alcoholism. So to deny it is just an extension of the addiction itself.
And what about domestic abuse in the Native American community?
Well, again? I mean, I grew up inside of it. I am not writing from an outsider's perspective. I am writing from a person who witnessed all of this in its various forms, all these social dysfunction and ills. So I am writing about what I know. And once again, to deny that is to be hurting us even more. And also, on a general perspective, you know, literature of all kinds is not about happiness.
It's great. Hard to write about happiness, actually. Great, and many writers have told me that.
Yes, great literature is not about happy. I mean, does anybody ever talk about that happy-go-lucky Ernie Hemingway? You know. First, a little light reading. I want to go for Gatsby. You know, Moby Dick. You know, there's a kind and gentle novel.
No, there is happiness in Hemingway, though. In The Sun Also Rises, when they get away from the women, and the men are just by themselves drinking, then they're happy.
They're happy, They, you know, nothing like homoerotic alcoholism in Hemingway. That sounds like a graduate thesis.
It is, probably. How much of an influence was Raymond Carver?
Oh, Raymond Carver was a strong influence. In fact, so much so that when one of our writing classes, one of the other writers wrote a parody of my work in Raymond Carver's style. And it was hilarious. He thought he was going to insult me and, you know, be really, you know, hurt my feelings. But
you were flattered.
I was flattered. That was the first insult to my whole writing that I ever received. It was great. So really, the minimalism, the scent, you know, there's not a whole lot of description in Raymond Carver's stories. And that's still one thing I do. I don't necessarily care that there's a pine tree near my characters.
You get right into the story and the
boom,
voice.
Boom. Yeah. I'm a dialogue-oriented writer.
You've been listening to a special encore edition of Forum. Our guest was author Sherman Alexie. He joined us to discuss his recently published collection of new and selected stories, Blasphemy. And there is another hour of Forum up ahead. Thank you for joining us. Merry Christmas.
Funds for the production of Forum are provided by the members of KQED Public Radio, the Germanicos Foundation, and the Generosity Foundation in honor of Louise and Claude Rosenberg, and by a generous gift from Jan Schrem and Maria Minetti Schrem, owners of Clos Pegase Winery, who believe that all people deserve access to education, information, and culture for a lifetime of exploration and learning.